October 5th, year 2000. This is an interview with Porter G. Peebles, Sr. The interview takes place in his office at the Urban League in Lexington, Kentucky, and the interviewer is Betsy Brinson. Mr. Peebles, could you give me your full name, please, so I can get a voice level here?
Sure. Porter G. Peebles, Sr.
Why don't you give me that again and see if it records better?
Porter G. Peebles, Sr.
Thank you.
I would say probably about 70 of us in the class, and probably 30, and it may have been more, but probably about 25 to 30 African Americans.
Okay. Well, how was that last year for you?
The year of integration? Very interesting. We had to make, you make some major adjustments because, your senior year in high school is what you live for, mm-hmm. in terms of, you've risen to be the leaders of your school, then you've got to go somewhere where you've got to share this with people who you're not too willing to want to share, and they certainly not willing to want to share because they were looking forward to being the leaders of their school also. So, probably an African American who would have been the president of our class had to share that with and the valedictorian. So all of those kinds of things. It was obviously brand new for everyone, the teachers. I'm sure we're not prepared to deal with African American kids, and most of the not many African American teachers, as I recall, came along.
What happened to them?
Many of them, as I recall, ended up being relegated to positions in junior high or teaching elementary school. Some retired. What I remember the most was my football and basketball coach, because you didn't come along. The entire football athletic staff was hired from that school.
Did they get teaching positions, or were any of them demoted into other than teaching?
I think they remained as teachers.
Mm-hmm. This was pretty late after the Supreme Court Brown decision in 1954. What took them so long?
What? And so I had a chance to know them growing up, but they were part of the out-migration in the 50s from eastern Kentucky to the following the automobile industry jobs going to Detroit and so forth. So her sisters and brothers, many of them moved on up that way. Over the years of maintaining a real close relationship with all those families. In fact, in my hometown right now, there's one remaining relative that's my father's brother, and that's my best friend and my fishing buddy now. We fish together all year.
Did you grow up in a church?
Yes. In fact, it's interesting that you would ask that, because I just had an interview yesterday with a clergyman who's doing some research on African American churches in eastern Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And sure, in my town there for the African American community, there were two Baptist churches and one Methodist. And I was raised in the First Baptist Church, very, very active, as most families were in the church. I can remember serving as a junior deacon in church, being in the choir, even though I could not sing, but I was there. Being very close and being raised in the church, going to Sunday school and all that.
And it was called the First Baptist,
First Baptist Church. Okay. Which burned down about 4 or 5 years ago.
Mm. Do you know what caused the
fire? No, it was just natural cause. No malice, none of the hate crime.
Okay. At what point in your growing up do you think that you recognized that you were living in a segregated society?
I knew all along because of the housing patterns in my town.
Tell me about that.
Okay. The Colton blacks lived on a few streets, and most white people lived on what was called Main Street. And it wasn't as it was visibly noticeable. But the town was small, and even though we didn't attend the same schools, all of the kids played together. Mm-hmm. What may have separated us may have been an alley. So we grew up playing basketball in the back alley together, playing football together all the time. And another thing you remember in the coal mining town, all of those men went into the same, 99% of the men in the town had the same jobs. And the women, just basically, it was very little out of home work. The women were housewives. But all of these men knew each other. And I'd also know, one of the things that I was very close with my father was fishing. And many of the men in that town, that's what they did. The weekends fished and on it. And, black and white men feel fish together and so forth. But there was still a lot of close knitness in the small town. They depended on one another mm-hmm. when they went into that dark hole to make a living.
Right. Let me ask you. You mentioned different housing, different neighborhoods and whatnot. Were there any differences in terms of like paved roads or
no
street
absolutely.
Lighting or anything? They were all the same.
It was all the same. The company owned all of the houses. Uh-huh. They built the houses. And then at a later date, they sold them to them, but they were all the same, yes.
Okay, so you graduated from high school, and then what?
Well, let me go back and mention also, in Kentucky, you had county schools, mm-hmm. and obviously supported by the state of Kentucky and the counties. In my town, we had independent schools that were all subsidized by United States Steel, which owned the town. And that, I would say that provided extra funds to which made our school system a little better than the county school system. Quality, I think some of us think that the quality of teaching, certainly the quality of equipment and so forth was better.
So there was extra money that could be used for textbooks
yeah.
and science equipment.
Sure.
And how about teachers' salaries?
That's what I was talking about, the quality. I think that contributed to that.
Okay. So when you graduated from high school, mm-hmm. what happened to you then?
Okay. I graduated from high school in 64. 4 years after they had opened the University of Kentucky had opened the community college in Cumberland, Kentucky, which was 5 miles from my home, which provided an opportunity for me to go on to community to college. Now there were 9 kids in my family, 4 brothers and sisters before me. Probably any of them would have had the same academic capabilities to go on to college, but the community college was not there. So after graduation, they had moved on away to various places, Ohio and New York and so forth. I entered the college there. But one of the things that also assisted me with my capabilities in the college is that we had a practice among African-American families in Eastern Kentucky, and it was predicated on our parents' visions of making sure that we had that we knew that there was a world outside the confines of those mountains. So black teenagers always were sent away in the summer to live with relatives in the northern cities, and that what they did was gave us the outside exposure, gave us an opportunity to work, make money, buy school clothes, and that provided an assistance to, or it reduced some of the financial burdens on our parents. From the time I was 15 to I graduated from college, I worked, with the exception of one summer, I would go to Brooklyn, and I would work in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
One summer,
you had relatives?
Yeah, I would go with my brother and sister, and then one summer I went to Cincinnati and lived with my sister and worked there. But if you can imagine I'm 15 years of age. My population in my town is probably about 2,000. I leave there on Saturday. On Tuesday morning, I'm working as a messenger boy in Midtown Manhattan, 19th Street, Park Avenue South, up to Rockefeller Center. Quite a growing up experience, but by no means was I intimidated, because I was too young to know that I was supposed to be intimidated by that kind of thing. That was most helpful to me, and I'm sure to all of my other African-American peers, because, as I said, it let us know there was a world outside. And what I most note that for is when I transferred as a junior to the University of Kentucky. University of Kentucky was not really large to me. There were only about 50 African-Americans on campus. Maybe 15,000 students, but that did not bother me after having a New York experience. Mm-hmm. So I am glad, very, very glad, and we were blessed as African American kids and teenagers to have parents who did that for us.
Mm-hmm. I understand from other people that I've interviewed that there's an Eastern Kentucky
Social Club.
Yes.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that? Are you a member?
I'm. I work, there's a club still based in Lynch.
And these are all people who
families
who've had students in the
area. Yeah, history is, under the history of that is, there was a, we talked about the out-migration pattern of people from the coal fields of Eastern Kentucky to Cleveland and Detroit, Chicago. Many of them falling, looking for outside job opportunities because, my parents, were kind of adamant that they didn't want us to go into the coal mine. So there was a feeling of a lot of them. So they would go north for those jobs. That started in the 30s, 40s, 50s. And about 30 years ago, there was a death and a funeral in Cleveland. Some of the people who went to the funeral were sitting, and there was some discussion about we only get together when someone dies, so we don't really get to have much fun and frolic together. So someone said, why don't we have a reunion? They had a reunion, thus the birth of what is now, I think, about 13 or 14 clubs scattered across the country, New York, Chicago, Cleveland, Detroit, Connecticut, Lynch, about 13, Dayton. Every year, a different club sponsors that. And during the course of the year, these clubs put on various fundraisers to fund their clubs, to have the monies to put on these functions. When you have this event, it's one big, wholesome coming together of people who have the commonality of having been raised in the coal fields of Eastern Kentucky, and it's 3 days of just being together and embellishing one another.
It was in Chicago this
no,
year?
No, just came Dayton.
Dayton.
Yeah, I just came back from Dayton.
Oh, okay.
Chicago year before, Milwaukee next year, and then 2002, the Lynch Club will be sponsoring it, and it will be hosted in Louisville. And obviously, Lynch can, it's not large enough and doesn't have the facilities. And I work with that club every time they sponsor it. They sponsored it here in Lexington once, and then we hosted it in Atlanta once. And after we left Atlanta, we had helped the Atlanta chapter get started. And then a few years later, they hosted it.
You said fun and frolic, but mm-hmm. In the 3 days, are there formal programs?
Oh, sure. You have, those are fun kind of events. You have there are events that you design especially for the kids who come. You have dances. Friday night is usually some kind of a disco dance. On Saturday, you have picnics and outings for families and friends. And another thing that works into that is, say, hypothetically, if it was here in, say, when it was here in Lexington, mm-hmm. my family and friends who came, we had a reunion within it at my house. Mm-hmm. We just come to my house for, I fish a lot, so I had lots of my friends and family over for a big fish fry in the backyard, kind of thing.
Is there any sort of social service component, for example, an effort to raise money for scholarships or anything?
That's been discussed, but I think we pretty much have left that to everybody to do in their respective cities. You've only got 3 days, and I think people just enjoy being together. But we have church service together on Sunday. Mm-hmm. In Dayton, they had a gospel fest on that Friday. One of the things that we're going to have when we have it in Louisville, we're going to take everybody on the boat ride. And so it's wholesome family fun.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm intrigued by the fact that families during the high school years would send their children off. I wonder, is that just something that each family knew to do individually? Was there any sort of organization that kind of pushed that?
No organization. That was just a kind of, it just became a pattern that families right. did. And it was because, you know, when my brother left, he knew that it would be beneficial for me to have that. My parents knew it would be beneficial. And every family felt the same way. It would be beneficial for us right. in terms of our own growth and development to right. see the rest of the world.
Did your parents, for example, ever go to New York City to see where you had been?
No, they didn't, but that didn't mean that many other families, I mean, a lot of the families, what they had in the coal mines every summer in July, they were shut down for 2 weeks for the vacation. And families would do things like my family and my father and his brother and some others, maybe go back to the home place in Alabama. Mm-hmm. Okay. And families would go to Cleveland to visit mm-hmm. relatives or drive to Detroit. But that was the kind
okay.
of thing.
So
that's the good thing now about these reunions. Every Labor Day, we're in one of those cities.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you went to Cumberland Community College?
Southeast Community
Southeast
College, yes.
Southeast Community College. And what did you study there?
I received an associate degree in education, focusing primarily on elementary education. Came on to the University of Kentucky, expanded that to special ed. Mm-hmm. Graduated in 68 with a dual teaching certificate in elementary and special ed. Taught in the Fayette County, I graduated like December, and I taught in the Fayette County Public Schools one semester. last semester I was in college, I lived at the YMCA. Here, 2nd Street YMCA here. During that same time, that summer, Mr. Walter Brown had come to open the Urban League here, and their first temporary office was in the YMCA. Mm-hmm. We befriended one another and had kind of a common bond because he moved down from New Jersey, and I did have some familiarity with the East, with New York and all. He moved the Urban League from the Y to the Westside Plaza that summer after I graduated from college. Now, during that summer, I was working for the Community Action Agency here in a program designed for juvenile delinquency prevention with young people. After I taught school, let me get that in sequence. Well, I graduated in December, taught school that spring semester, and during that spring semester, Mr. Brown had offered me an opportunity to come to work for him. So that following summer, I worked for Community Action and then came to work for the Urban League that fall. So I used my teaching degree for one semester. Mm-hmm. However, and it's really coincidental that still today, having been trained in special ed to work with the slow learners, and you learn the patience. Mm-hmm. And that's a virtue. That's a strength that I still use. I mean, that's an asset that I still use today in this work. Because if you're involved with changing systems, you must be patient. Otherwise, you'll be maximally frustrated all the time.
Let me go back to the University of Kentucky. Were you a member active with the Black Student Union at UK?
No, I was very active in the student council for special education, and in fact, I was probably the first African American to be a president of that council. Okay. during that time. I was working while I was in school. My parents didn't have a lot of resources, so I had to work and had to do that. So
what
we did have build. But I worked at the Bluegrass School, which was the school for the mentally retarded. Mm-hmm. I also worked at the YMCA. Mm-hmm.
And the YMCA then was down on
Second Street.
Where the Jefferson.
Yeah, where the Jefferson Vet Center is. Now, we had. Resource wise down there, we had almost nothing. We didn't have that swimming pool and all the everything they have there now. We had the backyard.
That hadn't been built?
No, that hadn't been built. We had the backyard and a dilapidated annex. Mm-hmm. What we had to do is to go swimming, we had to put the kids on a bus. We had a bus that would go around through the black neighborhood and pick up kids on Wednesday night and Saturday night, and we took them to swim up on High Street. Mm-hmm. And so that was my connection with the Y.
Okay. I'm interested to know, though, since there were so few of you at UK at that point in time, and I know a little bit about the history of the Black Student Union, so I know it was kind of a rocky road for a while. Did you just intentionally elect not to participate? Or
I participated, but I wasn't in a... I guess I raised the other one because I had a leadership. I was in a leadership role there. But yeah, sure, I participated. And while I probably may not have been as active in the Black Student Union, one of the things those of us who were there were very close-knit, once small family. And my senior year, I was able to put together enough funds with my father's assistance to buy a little raggedy car. And we didn't move that car off campus unless all of us were stuffed in there. Socially, there was not a whole lot for us on the University of Kentucky. So we would jump in there and go to Eastern, where there were more African-American kids, or we would go to Kentucky State. But very, very close bond among us there.
Okay. I'm interested in Walter Brown, that you mentioned, who came here as head of the Urban League and hired you. What you said he came from New Jersey.
Yes.
Tell me something more about
Walter was a Methodist minister who had worked for the Urban League, and I think he may have come directly here from Dayton, but New Jersey was his home. Mm-hmm. And he had worked for the Urban League in Dayton as sort of like a number two person. Mm-hmm. And came here to as the first executive director of this Urban League. Mm-hmm. And then he left here, and I think went back to New Jersey or to Virginia. But he gave me my first opportunity. You know, I'm here today because of something he saw in me and gave me an opportunity to do this.
What happened to him? How long did he stay here?
In Lexington, Walter left, and Walter didn't only stayed a couple of years, and then he left, and then I was put into an acting director's role for about a year and a half. Back during that time, I guess I had this youthful itchy feet that said they should have gone on and made the decision to make me the CEO. But as I look back, they did the right thing. I was not ready to take on that responsibility then. But being in an acting role helped me grow. And as they brought in other people to interview for the position, I got a chance to talk and learn some things from them. Developed a relationship with my mentor down the road, who is then Art Walters, the director of the Louisville Urban League. And then when they did pass the torch on to me, it still took some time for me to learn my way and become the responsible director that they needed, and I hope that I have become.
Okay. Tell me a little bit, please, about the mission of the Urban League, and also about some of the early programs here in Lexington.
Okay, the mission of the Urban League, being by definition, is to work for equal life opportunities for minority and equally similarly disadvantaged populations. Minorities carries different connotations in different segments of the country. We are 113 affiliates strong across this country. here, minority populations, primarily African Americans, and economically disadvantaged white population. Some of the projects there was, one of the reasons I came to work for Walter Brown is I had a degree in education. One of the first projects that he started was an education program that focused on typing, providing typing clerical skills for females. And so I came to set that program up. That was my first job with the Urban League. And I, interestingly, as we sit here now, 30 years later, we're still doing that same kind of training, but it's computer training.
Right. Did you run that out of the YMCA building?
No, all we had space was at the, when I came to work with Urban League, they had moved and opened in the plaza, Westside Plaza on Georgetown Street. Mm-hmm. Now, our first training classes were set up in a space provided at the Salvation Army. Mm-hmm. Then we expanded our space and started doing that training in our center up there on Georgetown Street. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'll turn the tape over here.
Sure. Being involved in advocacy roles with the kids in high school, that was still early integration time in Fayette County Public Schools, so you had to be there to advocate and intervene with high school kids, because everybody, you know, black and white, were kind of feeling their way through the educational process.
Was that one-to-one with students?
All of the above.
Okay.
Some one-to-one, some groups, you know, having groups with kids. And.
Okay.
We were doing some things with small minority businesses. I remember we had the Small Business Administration would send their financial counselor to the Urban League once a week, who would sit there and who would spend time with people who were looking for loans and the like. What were some of the other kinds of things that we did? Youth activities in the summer and those kinds of things.
How was the Urban League perceived by the white community in the early days in Lexington?
I think more importantly, it was how it was perceived by the black community during those
days.
That
would have been my next
question. You know, Urban League during, remember, we're talking about the turbulent, you know, 60s,
right.
Where you had, Dr. King and Whitney Young and some were seen as too conservative and not radical enough. So when the Urban League opened, there were some people who probably thought that, who, quite frankly, it was an Uncle Tom kind of group that was an arm of the white community. And so that was one of those kind of things that we had to work through. But that was kind of nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
By the white community, I think it was seen as a moderate group that would be welcome. At a time that we were having riots
and the African American community here.
That's what I was saying. There were segments of the African American community who probably saw us as too moderate, mm-hmm. and then there were some who welcomed it. So there were mixed reviews, but bottom line is, if you're an organization like this, it boils down to, what have you done for me lately?
Mm-hmm.
If people are the service recipients of what you do, they see you one way.
Mm-hmm.
If you've done nothing for them, they probably have don't have much perception of you. And some people just don't care.
Were there members of the African American community here, just given the rise of black nationalism and black power, that really advocated or worked to make you be a different kind of organization?
Well, not really, because I think one of the things that created more relevance for us is that I think some urban leagues across this country had sites where they were not as embedded in the community. And we were in the Westside Plaza,
mm-hmm.
and that was right in the heart of the African American community. So that helped with that helped with credibility with that population.
Mm-hmm.
We were right across the street from the major housing public housing units, Charlotte Court. We had job training going on in that center. We had people in and out of that center. So that helped dispel some of that notion that the Urban League will not be relevant to. I was still young enough that I developed relationships with people. And I was also, you know, when I became CEO, I think I was, I like to think that I was wise enough that we started to have hire people from the community who people could identify with. One of the first programs we had was a youth violence, we call Youth Services Bureau, which worked with as an intervention agency with kids going to court. Mm-hmm. And we hired people from the community. We called them street workers during that time who knew the kids, knew the families. We had about four or five of them, and those people were your ambassadors, your emissaries, your go-betweens between you and the grassroots community. As a CEO, I had to still maintain my role of developer, fundraising, and so forth. And with that kind of relation going, I think that helped dispel and move what could have been, you know, some change some perceptions.
That leads me to where I was actually going next, was to ask you about where did the early funds come from to establish the Urban League?
The very first allocation for the openness office was $25,000 in order to join the United Way, become a member of the United Way. $25,000 in public funds had to be raised. So there was a group who did that. And then we started to get supplemented to that tune going forward from United Way. We now are funded, I think, to a tune of about $140,000 from the United Way. But we are in excess, you know, total budget for this organization is in excess of $1 million.
And where does the remaining money come from?
Program grants, federal, state, local. We have, just to give you an example of a few, we have a senior citizens employment program that's to the tune of about $300,000. We do housing. And we do some financing for housing. We have a grant, HUD grant, of about $250,000. We have some under the Welfare to Work Act now. We have some work. We do some things with called Fatherhood Initiative, working with non-custodial fathers. We have a couple of grants with that. That's maybe about $100,000-$150,000. We have a program now working with young people and housing construction training, about $60,000. That's called youth bill. We're going to reestablish our construction training for ex-inmates that we've done for the last 10 or 12 years. Gov combination of criminal justice funds and governor's funds will be about $600,000. So it's kind of a plethora of different funding sources. That's my role is to do development.
Right. So the Urban League has been here now how many years?
68.
Okay, so roughly 32 years. Mm-hmm. So, has it changed over time? And if so, how?
The change has been just growth. The mission has remained the same. We've adjusted to different initiatives. Organizations who target working for low income and economically disadvantaged populations also have to be somewhat in sync with what the federal government is targeting to do with that population. We've gone through let's say major job training initiatives that we've gone through. That was something that first called. At first there was a war on poverty. That was going on when we first opened, but the Community Action Agency was the main participant in that. Then the government came up with this, what they call CEDA, the Comprehensive Employment and Training Act. We did training under that. Then during the George Bush, Dan Quayle era, that became what they call JTPA, Jobs Training Partnership Act. Mm-hmm. We did job training under that, and now it's under welfare reform, and we're still, so The focus has always been to do what we could for that population, do it in look for niches. Mm-hmm. that gave us kind of carved out opportunities for us to do what we do, but to do it for that population. And let me tell you what we did, you know, just from a philosophical programmatic standpoint. About 15 years ago, during the era of, I mean, when there was not a whole lot of federal sensitivity to nonprofit organizations, especially minority nonprofit organizations, from the then Republican regimes, we realized that in order to survive, that we had to have a thrust that was not only dependent on our trying to sell the mission that these are poor people who need attention, because that those administrations were not as sensitive to. We knew that we needed to have a business approach, look more like a business. So that's why we put in place a nonprofit, second nonprofit component of the Urban League that we call the Fayette County Local Development Corporation. And it had by its mission economic development and community improvement. And one of the first things we started to do is talk about rebuilding our own neighborhoods through housing. Now, in order to make sure that we didn't abandon our mission of working with the population, we said we were going to build houses for first-time homeowners who were low to moderate income, but we were also going to train ex-inmates who were returning to the community. And over the years, we've trained over 200 men. We closed in December on our 100th home. And as we sit here today, I will be reporting at our Urban League banquet October 30th that this year we've either financed or constructed 38 additional homes. So we've had a major impact. You know, we're talking about in excess of $7 million worth of real estate. As we sit in this building today, we're looking at a site that was totally dilapidated. We acquired it in January of 98. Through our training program, we refurbished this entire facility, and it is now our headquarters. And in the process of doing this, we said we wanted to redo this entire block. We went to the city and asked them to redo the infrastructure. 2 years ago, this was a two-way, very cluttered street, and now it's one-way widened. The business right next door is here as a result. Now, we also, this.
Let me ask you about this block. This is Deweese Street.
Yeah.
And for the transcriber, that's
D-E-W-E-E-S. And Deweese Street, during what was called the heydays of Lexington, was the hub of the black community. Many businesses thrived on this street, but as the same thing that happened in many cities, urban renewal came through, and what was left after that disaster was two blocks. There's one block that's consumed by National City Bank, and then this block, and that's why the Urban League, we were challenged to preserve this building, because this building has a significant history. It was once the medical facility for the black community. Dr. Dalton, Dr. Pope lived upstairs, but they provided medical service out of this area. So I wanted to preserve that history and preserve the history of Deweese Street. There also, there's a building across the street, which was once the state headquarters for Mammoth Life Insurance, and we've acquired that, and we're going to use that for overflow for office space. There's a duplex across the street that was part of this mecca once called Dewey Street. We've acquired that one. And we're going to start renovation of it and put a community technology center in there starting next spring. What we hoped is that we, by preserving this, that would kind of be, we would just be part of the whole process of revitalizing this East End. The Housing Authority has built 18 new houses over immediately to the left of us. On up the street, the Northside Clinic has gone in the last couple of years. Across the street from that is, on the corner, is the old historic Lyric Theater. That after litigation, I think is going to be either restored or a new facility will be built there. During the last year, we have taken the option on the entire block that sits immediately behind the Lyric Theater, and we're in the process of putting together a financial packet to build about 32 senior citizens apartment complex there for independent and assisted living. We're also involved in a project two blocks on up from there called the Rebirth of Elm Tree Lane. With the Housing Authority and the Urban League, we're putting together 19 new houses in there that will range from $80,000 to $110,000.
And for the transcriber, that's Elm, E-L-M, Tree,
T-R-E.
Two words,
yeah.
Tree Lane, okay. Well, two questions. One, you mentioned early on the Urban League had United Way support and continues today, I assume.
Sure.
Since I just saw it in the list of organizations that I can make my contributions to last night. But I wonder, how typical is it for Urban Leagues across the country to be United Way agents?
Oh, that's the core funding for all Urban Leagues. Okay. Every Urban League in the country is a United Way organization, and then their funding cycles, their funding support is similar to what I just described. They then get grants and so forth from other organizations to do other programs.
And my second question is, you sit on many memberships, boards, and commissions,
mm-hmm.
and I wonder, do you do that as part of your CEO function at Urban League? Do you do it because you're a good citizen?
No, I do it as part of the CEO function of the Urban League. One, your Urban League has an inherent role in its responsibility of advocating and intervening and advising. So you have to be at the table where decisions are being made. So that's a reason that we're involved in a lot of those kind of activities. I'm on the Kentucky Housing Corporation board, obviously bringing to there the minority perspective. I work on advisory groups with certain banks. I am the chairman of Fayette County Schools Equity Council. Obviously, the pushing for equity for minority students in the Fayette County school system. I have over the years served as a state chairman for the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and so we are very actively involved in those kind of matters. I'm involved with groups that are in charge with the responsibilities of running all of the job training programs, and we also have some selfish interest there too. We want to be there to make sure that as those pies are cut and distributed for agencies to have dollars to run, we want to advocate for our constituents and our organization.
Mm-hmm. Well, in all of those roles, what are some of the most controversial situations that you've had to help negotiate in the city?
Some probably around police community relations and schools.
Can you describe any in particular?
Well, we'll talk police community relations. One we just went through this year, the issue of driving while black. This time last year, a group of us were joined hands with the faith community to start educating this community and raising this consciousness about the disproportionate times that African-American drivers were being stopped versus the white counterparts. At first, the police chief, as most departments across this country, were in denial about it. We issued a challenge to the mayor and to the chief to do a demonstration where they documented all of the stops for 6 months. And then let's see what happens. Then that we, it was our position that we would move from the anecdotal to the real once we saw, and it proved to be, we proved to be prophetic in that and true. So now the chief and the mayor has adopted the policy that that would be ongoing practice, and that police officers would be, get certain sensitivity training and so forth to those kinds of practices.
Has this whole issue of racial profiling, is it a new issue or is it a historical one in Lexington?
I think racial profiling is, the practice is old. You know, black folks know it's old. But getting people of influence to recognize it and start to try to do something is still a new and ongoing struggle. If you, most recently, even the governor has stepped up and said they're going to have the state police start looking at it. And they're in denial right now. But I think that they will, once they start doing some documentation, they will see that it's a real, it's
who's
a real person.
Who's in denial?
I think that they, I mean, the state police probably, yeah,
okay.
Right now, just as our local police were.
Okay.
Because when they had the reason I say this, when they had the press conference, I was just listening to some of the language that they're saying, well, we'll do it to see, but we don't believe that our police, you know, do that. But that's the same thing everybody says.
And then you mentioned the other very controversial area was education.
Well, education. This school, as I think back some years ago when this district was ordered to integrate under court order. The sitting board made what I consider to be a very sinister decision to avoid having cross-busing. Cross-busing meaning bringing white kids downtown, black kids out. They made a sinister decision to close down several other downtown elementary schools, which robbed downtown elementary schools, downtown neighborhoods of elementary schools. Which, if we fast forward to the day, there's a lot of discussion about the merits of having neighborhood schools. You know, that's fine for the suburbs who have neighborhood schools, but that's not fine for the neighborhoods downtown who no longer have, you know, those neighborhood schools. But during that time, there was a lot of controversy around here about that decision. I can remember being part of marches on the board and on the school board members about that decision. I can remember when we started to hire the first school superintendent not too long ago, and under Kara, there were rules about who was supposed to be a part of this school board selection process. It was very controversial because there were no African American people on that panel. And we insisted that there was going to be some way, some avenue for our participation. It ended up even having to have the governor come down and do some intervention with that. We're still fighting this district through my equity council role about closing the achievement gap between black kids and white kids. There's still an abundance of issues in education, tied to equity.
I'm curious that you have stayed as long as you have, and as I listen to you talk about the program, I understand that better in terms of what you've been trying to build. But I wonder if you haven't ever thought of leaving Lexington.
There have been times that I've thought about it, but you make decisions based on what feels right for you. When I was younger and my parents were living, I really enjoyed being closer to them. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm three hours away, and you know, just for reasons of being there for them, and personal reasons of enjoying the time that my father and I still spent fishing and hunting together. Professionally, as I got into this job, it became more and more clear to me that agencies like this grow based more on relationships. And that I had developed some relationships that we could build up on. And that it made more sense to stay here and do that than move on for the sake of saying something else is on the resume.
And so
I've been very, very comfortable with that.
Do you have family now?
Yes. I'm in my second marriage. I have a wife and now and a stepdaughter and who's a junior at the University of Kentucky, and my son from my first marriage, and he has two kids.
And do they live
here? They all live here.
All live here.
All live here.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's nice. Well, let me see here. There was one other thing that was told to me recently, and I wondered if you could just enlighten me a little bit more. And that is the Antonio Sullivan situation in 1995. What was that? What was that all about?
Very, very unfortunate situation where a teenager was shot by a police officer, and that created, you know, very turbulent times and a rift between in this community, it's very tough for this community to deal with and go through that.
And how did the community, particularly the how did the black community respond to that?
Well, at first there was as close to you can get in this town to rioting, that was that, you know, your kids marched downtown, there was some rocks thrown and balls thrown between the police and there were some cars overturned, and there was some very tense days that followed that. I think coming out of that is something that is now in existence called Partners for Youth, which is an attempt to fund grassroots kind of organizations to do multiple things with youth. So that's one of the positives that I know came out of that. But it was a very, very unfortunate and tough time in this community.
Did you have a role in that in any way, or did the Urban League have a role?
Well, there's not much that goes on in this town that involves African-American people that we're not in some fashion. Yes, we were right in there. We were one of the first groups that were involved in meeting with the chief and the mayor, and we played whatever roles we could as intermediaries. But most of the leadership in that probably was with some faith leaders and some of the government officials, because it was obviously, you know, police work for the government and so forth.
Were there any important changes that came out of that incident?
Well, the one that I'd speak to the Partners for Youth, that's one of the things, and that's something that I've been involved in.
But you said it's non-existent now?
What?
The Partners for
Youth? No. The Partners for Youth is ongoing. Every year, Partners for Youth is a project funded out of the mayor's office. The mayor raises money. And there are a lot of smaller groups who are now funded to do different kinds of things. And that's all about prevention and involvement of young people.
Mm-hmm. And how does that work? How does the program work? Partners for Youth, are they partners?
The partners are the corporate contributors and so forth. And they raise the money with the mayor, and then the monies are distributed to various, like the Aspendale Teen Center.
Right.
Which is two blocks away from where Antonio Sullivan was killed, the YMCA, and various other groups who work with youth receive funds from this to do preventive activities.
Okay. Do you have any ongoing interactions with the teen center?
Only not from a programmatic standpoint. The Urban League, we're not really involved in a lot of youth activities. My major youth involvement is advocacy, you know, for. And let me explain that. You know, in 1991, well, we go through a very controversial period here in this community periodically, and it's under the heading of redistricting. And I refer to that as our periodic civil wars, because whenever you talk about redistricting, you talk about not Southside schools, Northside schools, where kids are going on assignment for kids to schools. And that usually always, it always comes up that people don't want the kids going to school on Northside because they're perceived as not being as well equipped. And some of that perception is real. A lot of it is real. But coming behind one of those redistricting processes, one of the school board members said, we need to look at our district just in terms of total equity. So if there are inequitable situations, we need to remedy those. So rather the next time we go to one of these redistricting, that won't be as much of an issue. So that was, they put together an equity task force. I was a member of that task force. And the equity task force came up with an equity report in 1993. And coming out of that report was a recommendation that we have an equity monitor for this district and have an equity, a permanent equity council for this district. So I rolled over from the Equity Task Force to be a part of the Equity Council, and I've chaired the Equity Council since 93. And we've played, I think, a very vital role in getting this district to the point of record, of admitting and recognizing the inequities and addressing some of those. And that's the advocacy role that I say that we've played. Programmatically, we've concentrated on housing, senior citizens, adults, on our community radio station. And how that always creates the divisiveness. In fact, we're getting ready, you probably have noticed in the media here recently, we're getting ready to start that process again. Superintendent just appointed a group that they call Overcrowding Committee, but it's the same thing. They're going to have to deal with redistricting, because if you got overcrowding, then you have to shuffle kids. Mm-hmm. So they're starting to look at those kind of options. But that's really very, a very highly controversial and very emotionally charged time that we go through. So, and we're usually right at the heart of that.
I wonder if the recent federal court decision about the Louisville school system.
Let me tell you, it's going to come into play this time.
That's what I'm wondering. It is definitely. It's true.
It has. While nobody's saying it certainly has. I would not be surprised to see some people probably think about challenging at this time. Okay. But you know, the real core of the problem for this community with that has to do with the housing patterns. Mm-hmm. We have segregated housing patterns. That's right. A given. And as long as you have those, it's going to be difficult to have truly integrated schools.
Right. Okay. I wanted to also ask you about your serving as chair of the U.S. Civil Rights State mm-hmm. Advisory Commission. Mm-hmm. When was that?
Gosh, I forget the years, but you know, what we would do with that was, our role was to have public hearings on certain issues.
And in the 70s, 80s? 90s?
Probably 80s.
80s, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, and what kinds of issues?
I know we had some on, some had to do with police relations, some had to do with public housing and those kinds of things.
Do you remember any of the other people that sat on the commission?
It was a statewide commission.
Right.
So we had representatives from Louisville, Bowling Green, from all over the state. Yeah. There were only two of us from here, myself and I think a guy named Paul Oberst who was with the UK Law School.
Right. And do you remember the names from other towns?
I know there was Bowling Green.
Right.
And I know Louisville.
But you don't?
And no. I could probably go to the file. And,
my next question is, are there any records for the commission activity anywhere that you know about?
Not that I would have, but at the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, sure.
Okay. have you ever done any international travel yourself?
No.
Okay. And my last question, or next to last question, is there anything you would do different with the Urban League, or you would like to see the Urban League maybe to have done some things differently during your tenure here, which has been a long
time. It has been a long time. I guess ideally, if I had had an opportunity to have a longer tenure as an assistant, mm-hmm. it probably would have helped me move better and faster when I did become CEO. That may have been helpful. Then too, maybe not. I don't know any CEO of another.
Let me stop and ask you about that. Do you mean because you moved at a rather young age, you had to learn everything?
Yeah. When I came on as I was one of the youngest in the country. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I was 22. Probably if I'd had 3 or 4 years of watching someone and being close to someone. I think I did okay, but probably in retrospect, more beneficial. I don't think there's a CEO of a nonprofit organization in this country who wouldn't say also that they would like to have had more money to work with.
But I'm
exceptionally proud of the way that we've managed what we've had. Exceptionally proud of the fact that we've stayed clear of scandal, because and we've had to dodge some attempts. Historically, organizations like ours, when you do get at odds with some people of influence, the way they try to come at you is they try to discredit you. Mm-hmm. And, one of the things I talk to my staff all the time about is we've got to be impeccable in terms of our management of funds. Mm-hmm. We've got to be able to withstand every kind of audit that comes. Mm-hmm. Our personal lives have to be above reproach, because, just last June, I had some public attacks. A couple of members of the Equity Council wrote some letters questioning. And I think I put some of that to bed immediately when I challenged both of those guys to lie detector tests. Mm-hmm. I said, we don't have to waste people's time with this. Let's take one.
What was the challenge that they were making?
Well, and those kinds of things, what's usually public is doesn't have anything much to do with the real issue. We went through a superintendent search last spring, and hired a new superintendent. Some of us in the African American community were pushing for better consideration of an African American candidate, mm-hmm. and that we couldn't get the sitting board and the interim superintendent to assure us that they would be on our side in terms of equity and so forth. So we weren't particularly enamored with that. So one of the board members, because the makeup of the Equity Council is that each board member appoints 2 people. Mm-hmm. So one of the board members who was most vocal against us, his two appointees, wrote letters questioning my leadership of the Equity Council, mm-hmm. saying that I had run some people away, I had done some, which was all untrue. Mm-hmm. But that's what I challenged them to. In the end, it was all proven to be untrue. But the way that thing works is, if it makes the press, then you're guilty.
Right. Well,
but my
that was certainly clever of you to come up with the lie detector.
Of course. Let's do it. If you feel like you're right, let's test it.
That's good.
And I went on television and made that challenge.
Was it quiet?
It was all put to rest. It just kind of went away. Then he later came back. The guy who wrote the first letter came back and said, in retrospect, he wished he would have discussed those issues with me rather than write the letter. Mm-hmm. But he knew what he wanted. The whole letter intent was it was a character assassination. Mm-hmm. Another thing that I told him after was all over is I've got a 30-year reputation in this town. And it takes more than one sleazy letter to bring me down.
Right. How would you compare Kentucky in terms of race relations now with other states?
Yes, that's interesting. I think, you know, Kentucky, and let's start in Lexington, is I think we're doing what a lot of other states and cities are still doing, is we kind of take one step forward and seem like two back or two forward, one back. And I think, you know, this whole reverse discrimination kind of thing has given some of the people who don't want to see us go forward in terms of race, it has given them impetus. Yeah, I mean, I'll bring that even closer to home. When we first started the Equity Council, we had the total support of that board, and I think we were making progress. We don't have the total support of the sitting board, and there are a lot of, you know, the same kind of tactics that are taken in the country, that were taken in the country to subvert progress made under affirmative action. We're starting to see some of the same kind of tactics with the Equity Council.
Would you want to say Kentucky, the history of race relations in Kentucky now is it any better than in some places? Is it worse?
It's kind of hard to say. I guess just kind of summarize. I say progress. You know, obviously we've made some, but we've probably got further to go than we've come. A whole lot further to go than we've come.
What about the future of the Urban League? Are there programs, policies, plans that you have for the Urban League here?
Yes, I think that you know, as an organization that's deeply involved in community development, I think we have a strong future. As an organization that has been very responsible, and I think that's really key, been responsible in its advocates, and when I say responsible, in that we document. You know, we don't take positions just based on some, even though emotions are involved, you have to have more than just the emotions when you take positions, because the opposition is always shrewd enough that they can disarm you with just emotions. You've got to have documentation. And in addition to documentation, when you take public positions, you want to be ready to make recommendations for remedies. And that's kind of been our approach to things.
Do you know a woman named Ann Beard Grundy?
Sure, very well.
Can I ask you a few questions?
Certainly can.
Okay. Do you know about the NEA Day Camp?
Mm-hmm. Some. I know that one of the things that Ann would tell you is that the NEA Day Camp operates in the summer. Is that I was one of the people who went to bat big time this summer with the Partners for Youth to make sure, even at the risk of offending some of my peers and fellow board members on the Partners for Youth board, you know, saying that it bothered me that Ann was having such a struggle getting money for that, when her agency was two blocks away from the site where Antonio Sullivan was killed, and we were funding other agencies all over the city. I think we had forgotten why the Partners for Youth came up. Ann and Catherine and Janet, the people who worked with that, I have nothing but praise and admiration for them and what they try to do.
And as I understand it now, they take a large number of children on bus trips all over the country
I see that as the same concept that our parents had because we were isolated in Eastern Kentucky.
Right.
Yeah, that's why I see the value. Why I see the value in that.
Right. So you all have been an official supporter in terms of helping with funds for the program.
Not providing the funds, but me advocating for funds.
Okay. The Roots and Heritage Festival here. What role do you see Anne having had in any of that, and how important has the festival been to the community?
The history of Lexington will have to be totally kind to the people who put together the Roots and Heritage Festival, for the role that it has played in galvanizing this community around that heritage. 40,000 people. I mean, that's a major event. You compare that to draws in this town, and the only thing I think that draws larger than that routine there is maybe a UK football game. And they have very methodically put that thing together and grown it and controlled it. And, you know, what can you say but great things about it? You know, admiring Catherine and them, the groups who put it. And they've gone about getting total community buy-in to that. Okay. And that's, I'm not so sure if at the beginning there were some people in the white community who would have thought that they saw themselves buying in and supporting that to the degree. Some people probably saw it initially as just this little black community event that'll stay over there, not swelling to be the event that just draws folks from all over.
Well, how do you know Ann? Do you remember first meeting her?
Well, Chester and I went to UK together.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so we have just this personal relationship to go way back. And professionally, you know, Ann is a very active person in terms of education advocacy too. So we've locked arms on that battlefield.
Some people would say she's a controversial leader in her advocacy.
What's the definition of controversy?
Some people.
And that's my question to them.
Okay. Well, what? How do you see that?
I think. If you're going to have a team. Yeah, you've got to have folks who can play different roles in different positions. That's what makes it a team. You know, everybody can't play just the same position. One of the things that Hugh Price says, as my national CEO, is some people have to raise hell to say that there's a bridge. There's no bridge, and then somebody have to come and build a bridge.
And how do you see Ann's contribution to the team?
Oh, when I've worked with Ann on it, you know, Ann has always been, Ann is one of those people who can be very vocal about issues, but also Ann is one of those kind of people who can get behind the scenes and help you write some of the best presentations you have to support some of the kinds of things. So, and what I also like the most is she's unselfish, you know, her eyes on the prize.
Thank you. Is there anything else that we haven't talked about today that you'd like to add to this interview?
I'm sure we've missed something because we're trying to talk about 30 years. I'm sure we've missed something.
Yeah, we just begin to touch.
But let me just tell you that as you review it, or if you review it, if there are some gaps that you find, I'm willing.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, this is something that's near and dear to me. And not because of me, but because of the Urban League, because the Urban League is near and dear to me. I consider myself a person who's blessed to have had the opportunity to serve in this position, and it has been more than just a job.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
We were talking earlier about the oral history project that you've done with the Urban League. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah. My interest in that was piqued one time when I was just reading a paper and saw where there was someone doing some oral history interviews of governors. And I said, gosh, this is a way for the Urban League to get involved in capturing history from through the eyes of some African-American people. So we went to the commission and got our first grant. Ricky Wright or George Wright was at the University of Kentucky then. Right. So he and Terry Birdwhistle, orchestrated our first batch. Mm-hmm. Then we did some more. I think we've got one grant one time that focused only on African-American women. Mm-hmm. And Ann Grande and Dr. Bill Parker, Emily Parker, mm-hmm. did those. Yeah, I think we've had probably, I can't remember exactly, but maybe about 3 or 4 grants. And I like to think that we've got pretty close to 200 tapes archived now.
And so they're over in special collections at the University of Kentucky, but you have a copy.
I have a copy here, and we've also shared with families, copies. Mm-hmm. And even today, I still hear from people whose family members own those tapes who've passed on. They tell me how they now treasure.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Those tapes, and I also advise people who I know and talk to, to, while, I mean, it's not a matter of how professionally the tapes are done, but make sure that you record your family mm-hmm. some way.
Mm-hmm. So has the focus been on family history in the Black community in Lexington?
Family history, whatever.
Community
history. Yeah, if the person, whatever their respective occupations and roles were, we want to capture that.
Right. Other than collecting a very important collection and placing it where researchers can use it, do you have any other plans?
Well, we did get a few of those transcribed at this mm-hmm. point. But ultimately, my dream is to have a book.
To have a book, right. Have you collected any photos, I wonder?
No, we don't have any.
That is something that many of us in history are conscious yeah. of, that we don't have very
yeah.
a very good photograph.
When you ask that question, it brings up, in my role with the Urban League, how many other things I would love to be doing. Mm-hmm. But we do as much as we can with what we have. And we find that what that does is we're always in position. We're usually in position because someone else will come along and say, well, we can take this and build on it. The tapes that we have right now, we're in dialogue with Gerald Smith and Joe Grace mm-hmm. about moving to that next step
right.
of the book.
Right.
And I just always had a dream that we'll do as much as we can, mm-hmm. Good things will follow. And that's kind of the way we do. Philosophically, I always say to my staff, what we're going to do here at the Urban League is we're going to continue to do the right thing for the right reason, mm-hmm. and hopefully right will prevail.
Earlier, you gave me the present amount of the Urban League budget, but I neglected to ask you, how many staff are there?
Right now, I think I saw something. I think we have about, there are, right today, 11 full-time, and we have a few other vacancies that we're getting ready to fill. Mm-hmm. Probably this fiscal year we will rise to 15 or 16.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay.